to 216, the Link to the Past Randomizer podcast. I am your host, Fear Agent. If you're joining us for the first time, 216 is the number of checks that are available in a Link to the Past Randomizer game. We here on the podcast are trying to do all 216 checks. Welcome back to week six. Got a good one for you with Drossy. Going to be a two-episode week. We got the Drossy episode that you're currently listening to. And then we'll be back on Thursday with T-Sigma 6. Put those two together because we talk a lot of League and history of the League. And those are two of the people that are running the League. And I just thought it'd be interesting to hear from both of them. So a two-episode week, going to be a good time. We've got the main tournament wrapping up here soon. We're in the semifinals. We've got our top four competitors. Schulzer was able to best P-Train 2-1 in a really interesting game three, where Schulzer was ahead and they were both looking for, I think it was an Aether Medallion to get into Turtle Rock or something. And there was a bunch of pendant dungeons available. Swamp, Ice, and Mire, I believe, were the dungeons. And P-Train got the medallion to get into Mire, which I believe was Quake. Don't quote me on any of these medallions, which was in K45, which Schulzer ended up skipping. And with P-Train being a little bit behind, he obviously not knowing he was behind, he had a fake flipper freeze where he fake flippered and got hit. What happens with fake flippering in the past is when you would in rando, they changed it to when you got hit, you would just die. Now, they tried to get it back to more of a vanilla behavior, I believe. And so it tries to put Link back on solid ground. And a lot of times you'll just like freeze the game or hard lock the game. And if you wait like a minute and a half or so and don't press any buttons, you will be able to save and quit out of it. But it takes forever and it feels like your game's crashed. I'm not crazy about that switch that they made. I liked it better when you just died. But apparently this happened to P-Train. And so he lost a bit of progress and was feeling behind. Anyways, he ended up in Mire first, where the medallion was needed to get into Turtle Rock. Maybe it was a medallion, maybe it was Fire Rod. I can't remember. The go mode item that they needed was in Pendant Mire. And P-Train got there first, despite being a bit behind a Schulzer. It was Ambrosia, so they're guaranteed, and there's guaranteed an item on the boss. And P-Train, getting a God Mire, went immediately to the boss, got the item, and left. He ended up doing the other pendants and pulling pedestal for powder, which was ended up being nothing. Schulzer got to Mire after P-Train, but didn't immediately go to the boss and was able to get his go mode item in the cutscene chest in Mire and was able to take game three. It was a really interesting race going back and forth, but that means there is no P-Train versus GFE semifinals. So rip the Spherefinity matchup we were hoping for. And then my pick, of course, Zelga is out. So everything in Scottish Brave versus Zen Arcane, which I was hoping for as well. All of my dreams have been crushed. But Schulzer is a really good runner and has a real good shot at taking this whole thing down. He's facing up against GFE right now. Currently, Schulzer is up one game over GFE. Over on the other side of the bracket, we had Andy take the win over Airy, going 2-1. Unfortunately, I didn't really get to watch any of these matches, but Solsky's got him restreamed on his channel, so you can go check those out. And I know Andy has them on his YouTube page, too. Always a treat to watch Andy and Airy race, so make sure you get a chance to check those out. We also had Obscure over Zero Rush 2-0. Obscure is a pretty aggressive runner, and it paid off game one with his kind of aggression. And same thing with game two. He ended up going into Skull Woods and got Mirror and Hookshot. And from there, just avalanched into taking a big lead. And Zero, despite his best efforts, wasn't able to recover that one. So Obscura moves on to the semifinals to take on Andy. I don't think any games have been scheduled yet for that, but that's going to be a good matchup. So we've got Andy versus Obscure and Schulzer versus GFE, with Schulzer a game up. And I believe they're going to be playing games 2 and 3 this coming weekend. So we're going to be crowning a champion here pretty soon. And more likely than not, I mean, just from the odds, 3-1, we're going to be crowning a new champion. Andy's won this thing twice. Can he make it a third time? I don't know. It's going to be really interesting. It's fun seeing fresh faces in the tournament. And when you think of runners like GFE and Obscure and even a little bit of Schulzer, it's like, it makes sense with kind of the modes that were ran this tournament that it's not as, I don't know, execution is obviously super important, but there's, you know, the modes are all kind of all over the place. And runners that can take advantage of those modes are winning. So that's really good to watch. Who's going to be the champion? I'm going to pick Andy just because he's really good at the game. My prediction is Andy versus Schulzer in the finals. I'm friends with GFE. I would like to see him win. Being down a game is going to be tough to come back from. Yeah, Schulzer is really good. And then I think Andy takes it, let's say, in three versus Schulzer. So that's my predictions. It, just like everything else I've predicted, is probably wrong. We've got SGDQ starting right now, actually, as I'm recording this. The first run just finished. And unfortunately, no Z3 this year. There's no Link to the Past. Not even the vanilla game being ran this GDQ. A little unfortunate. I always love to watch a little Z3 being ran on the big stage of GDQ. GDQ is such a huge moment in the speedrunning community every year when it happens. It's kind of what brought so many people to the game, or to speedrunning and to Link to the Past for sure, specifically the randomizer. And it's just fun to watch. I mean, GDQ's just grown and grown and grown over the years. So no Z3, there's some others, all the stuff on the schedule, but the things that I'm actually looking forward to is there's a Super Mario World Relay Race Friday night with Barb and Carl Sagan and Jez Cook and a couple more. And then, I'm definitely going to check that one out. I kind of like to have it on in the background as I go through my week too when I can, just to pick up some random stuff here and there. And then I'll watch some of the other things on YouTube that I missed. The other big one that I'm going to make sure that I watch Saturday night is the Mario Maker 2 relay race, I think. That one's got Grand Pooh Bear and Panga, Carl Sagan, Orator, and a couple more people. And before I was actually into Link to the Past Randomizer, I kind of got introduced to speedrunning and to Twitch and to all of it through Super Mario Maker, the first Super Mario Maker. I watched a lot of Grand Pooh Bear. I watched a lot of Panga. I remember when Panga did his blindfold run of Super Mario World. And so I was like into the world of gaming, but I wasn't into the world of speedrunning. But when Super Mario Maker came out, that kind of introduced me to a whole new world of stuff. And so when I was watching Pooh Bear, and then he kind of introduced the world of speedrunning alongside Mario Maker and GDQs. They were at a couple of GDQs early on, and that introduced me to like Carl Sagan. And I really got into all of the Mario Maker stuff, and that ended up being shifted over to the Link to the Past randomizer stuff when I saw Andy versus Christos Owen, AGDQ 2018. But I have a real love for all Mario Maker stuff. Still watch like Pengas and the Beasts Super Mario Maker 2 videos on YouTube almost like daily. They come out daily, and I'm all over them. So I'm really looking forward to the Mario Maker 2 run on Saturday night GDQ. Should be a good time. Love to hear what people are looking forward to to this GDQ. A lot of fun runs, and you know, the thing that I love about GDQ is discovering speed runs for really interesting games that you've never even heard of or are first time introduced to. It's that's like one of the really cool things about GDQ. So check that out. Join the Discord, of course. You can join the GDQ Discord, but join my Discord. The 216pod.com website has a link to the Discord, and we can chat about GDQ. A lot of stuff going on this week, and it's going to be fun to watch. But we've got a good episode today for you. We've got Drossy on the show, who is a longtime friend. The only person in the community that I've met in person. He does a lot of traveling. We'll talk about that in the show a little bit. And he was in my area and asked to meet up, and we went and had dinner and just had a really good time. And that was before he was an admin for the league. And I ended up bringing him on as an admin for the league in season 3, along with Dante and Relkin and Sigma, and then eventually Amerith. And so really close to Drossi. Put a lot of faith in what he brings and his knowledge of both the game and of just management and numbers and spreadsheets and things. Like, that's the one thing that I'm not good at. I'm not the best organizer. I'm definitely an idea guy, and I need people that I can trust to help make it a reality. And the league wouldn't be what it is today without Drossi there, you know, helping me make sure that I'm crossing my T's and dotting my I's. And so just a really good friend and super invaluable member of the community as well. Does a lot of work behind the scenes. He's like the volunteer coordinator over at Speed Gaming. So if you've ever wanted to volunteer for Speed Gaming, help them get streams going, the restreams going, and that kind of thing. They need lots of help with the setup helpers. Drossi's the one to talk to, so shoot him a DM if you're interested in that. It's pretty cool seeing the behind the scenes work of the Speed Gaming machine. It's fun. It's a good time. So, a really good conversation. I hope you really enjoy it. So, let's get into it. So, I have a real fascination, Drossi, with members of the community that are prominent members of the community but don't race. So I thought it'd be a super interesting conversation to talk to you, because you are a very prominent member of this community, a league admin, and you do a ton with Speed Gaming as well as commentary. You do a lot of commentary as well. So I'm excited to kind of pick your brain in what it is that keeps you a part of the community when you're not racing. So,
I mean, you've seen me try racing. I haven't done very good at it.
That's okay. So let's just kind of start there, right? Like, so what brought you to A Link to the Past Randomizer?
So I'd actually been following speedrunners on Twitch for a while. If you want to go way back, you've probably heard of Andrew G, famous early Super Mario speedrunner. He's in my local area and was featured in the local paper in the early days of speedrunning. So that's how I first came across it. And then when Twitch came about and people were speedrunning lots of things, I started watching, you know, SMB3 and then Zelda. You know, I had played a lot of the Mario and Zelda games as a kid, the early ones. So I would just kind of browse Twitch by category and was watching a lot of ALTTP, NMG runs or what have you. And, you know, suddenly these rando players started showing up in the category. So that was the first I'd ever heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Were you watching Twitch pre-Twitch, like when it was just in TV, or what?
Not that long ago. I want to say maybe around 2013.
Okay. Okay. So what? You were just interested in, because you weren't speedrunning yourself, you were just interested in video games and watching people.
Yeah, I mean,
win.
You know, stuff that I knew I'd never have the execution for, but it was nice to see other people doing these crazy tricks with these video games of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. So did you ever have like a competitive itch to even attempt speedruns? Or was that just like, I like playing games for fun and
I thought about it. I also realized that I didn't naturally have the reflexes to do something like that, and probably didn't have the patience to train myself to develop those reflexes. That was kind of an early realization, especially on rare occasions. You know, I still have my old consoles at my parents', so I can sit down on the original thing. But yeah, I sit down on the original thing and it's horrible when I try to do all these tricks I see online.
I just picked up a NES controller last week and played some on an actual old NES of my buddies. and it was weird, which is strange to say because I play on a Super NES console all the time. Or controller on a Super NT, but it just feels that much more retro than a Super Nintendo controller feels.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It is so clunky in hindsight.
It really is. It's the two buttons and the square, the rectangle shape. It's just so awkward.
And it's like the buttons all feel so stiff, too.
They do. But they really knocked it out of the park on their next go with the Super Nintendo controller, because that is like a perfect controller that doesn't have, 3D capabilities.
Yeah, it is designed to fit your hands, and, you know, some of the buttons stick out, others stick in, so that you can kind of tell which button you're doing by feel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nice innovation.
Were you an old school gamer then? You had all the original consoles and...
Yeah. I mean, primarily NES, SNES, and Game Boy were what I kind of grew up playing.
So the Mario and the Zelda, that's kind of where your love for it comes from?
Yeah. I mean... Personally, I wound up spending more time as I got older on JRPGs because they were less execution-based, and I would often, even as a kid, get frustrated with myself. I mean, I couldn't beat most of the Mario and Zelda games. I never beat Super Mario 3 until Lost Levels came out and I was able to save. I never beat Zelda 2 until I could do it on emulator and use save states and cheat codes. I mean, some of those games were hard.
I know. I mean, I've been doing a Zelda replay with my friend offline, and we started at, you know, Zelda 1, which I'd never beaten. I played it a ton as a kid, but I had never beaten it just because as a kid, it's really hard. And
I mean, Zelda 1 kind of became my thing as a kid, that I actually got pretty good at beating both quests without dying.
Oh, wow. That's impressive, because I died a lot. And that was just recently, like a few weeks ago. So then me and my friend went to Zelda 2. I don't know if I've been more angry playing a video game. It's weird because it's like it is a fun game, but it's also super maddening at the same time.
And if you don't know how to optimize your experience growth, which as a kid I didn't, wind up doing so much grinding. I mean, as an adult watching speedrunners who have figured out how to optimize their experience by placing gems, you know, when they can get an attack level with lots of experience, you know, that's so different from what I was doing as a kid where, you know, if you want to grind out level 8 attack, it takes forever.
Yes. Yeah, totally. I actually... You know, I have a ton of nostalgia for Zelda 1, but as a kid, I actually didn't really play Zelda 2 because it was so difficult and I had already moved on to other stuff by the time we kind of had it. So I don't have that sort of same nostalgia for Zelda 2. But Zelda 3, on the other hand, was super nostalgic for me. Was it the same for you?
I mean, so I had several years of playing NES before the SNES came out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's certainly a much better made game than Zelda 1 or Zelda 2.
Sure. So, but were you a gamer? Were you gaming a lot, or was it more of just a casual thing?
I mean, I was playing a fair amount. I wanted to be able to beat these games. I couldn't beat every game I owned. It was frustrating. Mm-hmm. I was better at some than at others. My big thing was once I got ALTTP down some, being able to beat that without dying, of course, that took several hours of playing, and I couldn't. As a kid, you can't do that in one session. Your parents get mad, so I'd, like, you know, leave the console on overnight and come back to it the next day.
I'm not sure if I ever beat it as a kid. Without dying, I'm sure I had a Farrier or two packed away.
Farrier revivals. Yeah, I probably was relying on that, but just I wanted in the credits at the end it to show zero deaths.
Right. So you say you were more into JRPGs as they came out. What were you playing?
Well, I mean, the first SNES games I remember getting after, you know, Super Mario World, which came with the console. Mm-hmm. Were ALTTP and Final Fantasy IV. I was super into Final Fantasy IV around the same time. Again, since 2 and 3 hadn't come out in the US, I'd played 1, and it is just such a big jump from 1 to 4.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, JRPGs is just something I just could never really wrap my head around. Like, I feel like I don't have the patience to sit through turn-based combat and things like that and leveling up. And I always felt, it made me feel dumb. Because I didn't feel like I understood what was happening.
Level grinding was sometimes frustrating, of course. It was worse than the Dragon Quest games.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy had it a bit better, though. Again, Final Fantasy 1, first installment problems, definitely clunky there.
Mm-hmm.
Final Fantasy 6, I remember, after hearing some friends rave about it, I went out. By that point, it had already... it had gone out of print, so to speak. I had to get it at a used game store.
Oh, wow.
Somehow I'd missed the boat on it. And but yeah, once I got Final Fantasy VI, that was really like mind-blowing for me.
Which console was that on?
SNES.
Oh, it is? Okay. So it went from 6 to PlayStation, or from SNES to PlayStation?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep, it was a big jump even at the time.
Yeah. Because I remember when Final Fantasy VII came out, it was hugely hyped. And again, I didn't understand it. Like, I just had no true understanding. I feel like I needed a friend to guide me into the world of JRPGs, and I didn't have that.
Well, they added materia there. That really, you know, that was when it started getting over my head, too.
Sure, sure. So, did you stick with Nintendo, or did you start to move into other stuff as that came up? As things progressed, like the 64 and the GameCube and things like that?
Well, by that point, I was in college, and I didn't have consoles with me at college or anything. I don't think I had a TV in my room, even.
Oh, wow. So you kind of took a break from gaming? Did you move into maybe
PC gaming? Well, actually, that's where I got into emulation. Because, okay, emulators existed, and especially with this JRPG... interest of mine, around this point, they were doing translation hacks of a lot of JRPGs that hadn't been released in the U.S. in English. So like Final Fantasy 2 and 3 for the NES, 5 for the SNES, Dragon Quest 5 and 6 for the SNES. All of these, they were in different stages of development. We're talking like late 90s, early 2000s here. So I was playing those on my computer as I could get my hands on them, you know, basically finding the ROMs online. I still have them. It's funny seeing the date stamp sitting there because I haven't edited them. They're still sitting there literally with like date stamps of 1998.
Wow. That's awesome. So you're able to go back and play some of that old stuff. Does the love of... old video games does it ever translate as you move out of college into anything new? Or because, you know, we're stuck in this ALTTPR world. We're stuck in the retro world.
I mean, I just was never able to get into the 3D stuff because I'd spent so long playing 2D, you know?
I think it happens to us old men, right? Like we grew up.
I mean, the same for Final Fantasy, because all of the newer Final Fantasies since 7 have been, a 3D setup, and I was never really able to make that transition either.
Yeah, I guess it has something to do with our age, because I'm stuck in the past too. Like I'm just a little younger than you, just a shade younger, so I was like really into the Nintendo 64, but I had a GameCube and I like purchased Wind Waker but never played it on my GameCube. It took me until I like emulated Wind Waker on whatever, like the Dolphin emulator or whatever it is, and beat it there. But yeah, the 3D stuff was like you reach a certain point, and it's usually, and I guess it's probably different now for younger kids because video games are more integrated into everything, right? Like when you and I were playing video games in the 80s and the 90s, it's kind of, you're like kind of a nerdy person,
yeah,
or you were young, right? Like there was
I remember in college when I went to my first party where the music was being supplied by MP3s, and it seemed so nerdy.
Yeah, that
is. As opposed to people putting CDs in the CD player.
Right, that is funny. So you do take an interest to the stuff that's going online, and you join and you start watching Twitch. And I'm sorry, who did you say was the first person that you started watching on Twitch, or do you even remember
that? So long, long ago, Andrew G was kind of the first speedrunner I had been aware of, though, you know, he's kind of run in fits and starts, so he wasn't really running as much at that point. The first speedrunner I started watching regularly, and you've probably never even heard of this guy because I haven't seen him play for years now, Cujo IHSV, who there was a period where he was pretty much second to Mitch Flowerpower as an SMB3 speedrunner.
Mm. Yeah, I've never heard of them. It took me a long time to get actually into speedrunning and realizing that Twitch was a thing. Like, I had no idea. It's
and obviously, Mitch is still around a decade later.
Yeah, it's funny to find out that, you know, there was people doing speedruns way before it's as common as it is now. So it was Super Mario 3? Is that what you said it was?
Yeah, I had a Super Mario 3 thing, and it was cool to see people speedrunning that. And then, you know, since Twitch allows you to browse by category, I was looking at people speedrunning other games that I had enjoyed as a kid, especially the Mario and Zelda series games in general. Yeah. So that's was how I kind of...
This was pre-Rando, or was it still... Or was it around the time Rando started?
Well, I mean, it's funny because so many people say their first exposure to ALTTPR was Andy versus Christos at AGDQ. I was totally unaware of that.
Oh, like, wow.
I was exposed to ALTTPR around the same time, but it was just dumb luck from browsing the category on Twitch, and some people, you know, were saying in their stream titles that they were streaming a randomizer version, and, this is cool, you actually have to solve puzzles again, rather than just beating the exact same game over and over again.
So it was around 2018 when you first started watching
Rayman.
Do you remember who the first person was that you watched?
I honestly can't even, like, who knew it was going to become part of my life 4 years later?
Like, could you imagine how involved the hook that would land inside of you?
And even then, it was like probably a month or two before I even learned that it was raced competitively. You know, a lot of the first people I watched were people who were just running it to challenge themselves, not to race it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an itch to fire it up then?
I mean, at that point, part of it was I didn't feel super motivated to go looking for the Japanese version 1 ROM figure out how to load it in and everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah. that dampened my own desire to immediately get into it like that.
All the work it took to just play it, to get
and
it
also
gone.
the amount of play time. I mean, even then I knew that, you know, seeds were frequently hour and a half, 2 hours, what have you, and that was for, you know, people who'd been doing it a lot, and so if I wanted to play it through, it was going to take me a lot longer than that. So again, it was a time commitment issue.
So what took you from being a spectator into, was your first role commentating, or did you volunteer with something else?
So when I discovered it was being raced, which was probably just, I popped into the stream of someone who was racing it, and they had in their title, you know, restream on speed gaming or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I should go over there and check out what it's about. Oh, they're having people racing. I don't even know exactly when this would have been, probably around the Key Sanity tournament time, I want to say. So just before the 512 Swiss.
Okay.
That's about when I'd placed this at, that, you know, the first time I actually watched a race on Restream was during the Key Sanity tournament in early 2018. Mm-hmm. And so something kind of got to me. Oh, there are these commentators and these trackers, and I don't think I necessarily have the manual dexterity to, like, really play this game at a competitive level, but it seems like it would be fun to, you know, be behind the scenes talking about it, or even just, you know, clicking the buttons as a way to get to better understand the game. So I very intentionally started with tracking before comming.
Oh, so did that allow you to learn more about logic, and how the game was played and like mechanics.
Yeah, exactly.
And stuff.
You know, I listened to the comms talk about it. You get sense both by watching more and more matches and listening to comms talk more and more. I can tell you exactly when my first time tracking was, May 7th, 2018.
Wow.
Okay. Because the 4-year anniversary just came up, and I even, like, in the main tournament tracker channel, I even dug up, you know, the link to me being very confused about where do I go to track?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And that was that for Speed Gaming?
Yeah, it was, I think, about the sixth week of the 512 Swiss on the Speed Gaming restream.
So you tracked for a while then, I imagine, just kind of playing behind the scenes, because there's a lot of people that track that never kind of move into the commentary role.
And especially with the comm application process.
Oh, right.
You know, and at that point, it was already pretty late in the Swiss. I was like, you know, I'm probably not going to be in a position to put together a commentary application for this tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, because yeah. of the Swiss taking up so many slots, Speed Gaming had put the dailies on hold, so I couldn't break in by comming the dailies
sure.
at that point.
It's funny to think back how much has changed as far as commentary goes, because, you know, if a 512 Swiss was to be ran again today, and you knowing what it's like to administer something, trying to find enough comms and trackers and all that stuff to do any of that.
I don't know how they did that. Like, again, if you go back in the main tournament server, Iceman compiled all the statistics for the 512 Swiss, and like, more than half the games were restreamed somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that burned out a lot of comms and trackers.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, right? Because, you know, we'll get into the league stuff in a little while, but for Season 4, we changed things where we just allowed anyone to react to a role, read the rules, and commentate, right? And you're talking about when you first joined, or when you first started tracking, there was a whole application process that I think the main tournament did until last tournament.
I mean, they just streamlined it this year.
Yeah, yeah. I think you still have to apply, but...
But it's a much more streamlined application.
Yeah, I mean, for a while, there was a whole quiz and everything that you had to take.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
I remember
which is
that.
So funny. I actually never took a quiz. I never actually took one. They just kind of gave me the role. I kind of looked into that.
Oh, no, I still probably somewhere have the chat where I think in the name of DT went over my answers with me. Mm.
You know what? I'm wrong. I did take a quiz because I got something wrong. I think for some reason I thought the Moon Pearl could be on the island, like Hylia Island for something. I think I answered that one question wrong.
Oh,
I want to say it was like Sabotender messaged me and did a mic check and told me what I got wrong. Now that I'm remembering back, but yeah, can you imagine going through that now of trying to like interview people and do all that stuff to get them to calm?
Okay, so I pulled up this chat with DT, which apparently I did the quiz. Back in April of 2018.
Okay.
I just pulled up my DMs with him. This is actually kind of amazing because I had no idea what we were, because I knew I started tracking well before I ever calmed, and that I had first calmed in early May of 2018. But here's a message from DT. Date stamp is 4/26/2018. And that he said, just wanted to go over something quick with you about your commentator quiz, with the question being, you have Moon Pearl, Titan's Mitts, all three medallions, flippers, and flute. What dungeons can you enter and obtain at least one item from?
Moon Pearl, flippers,
Mitts,
and flute?
And all three medallions.
And all three medallions. Okay.
And
so, what's the answer? Skullwoods, Thiestown, Pod, Eastern.
And apparently that's it. I mean, not apparently, you and I both know that's it. I hadn't realized, oh, you don't have the flipping sword, so you can't actually use any of the medallions, so you can't do anything in ice or mire, so I have listed ice and mire as well.
Oh, man, trying to trick us. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to keep
you. Yeah.
It just goes back to how different things are from 4 years ago, right? Like, it took a bit more knowledge, and it took, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing necessarily, but it felt like you had to, felt like there was a bit more of a bit more gatekeeping into the commentator role back then.
Definitely. Maybe.
So you do a bunch of tracking, then you, were you denied comms for that, or did they let you
commentate? No, I never, because you also had to do a sound check, and again, you know, I didn't have the greatest setup. I never got around to doing a sound check, especially since it was already relatively late in the Swiss.
Sure,
and
sure.
I was like, do I really feel comfortable calming? I think I'm fine just tracking for a bit. And then I think at some point that summer, like June-ish, the SG dailies had come back, and I signed up to calm one of them. And wouldn't you know it, I had technical difficulties and had to be removed.
Oh, really? Your first comm, you didn't actually get to comm?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's, and then it was another couple,
I think,
of months.
Cursed, right? The curse.
Yeah. That you still feel bad because I think I was supposed to be paired with Kern, and best I know, only once in my life have I ever actually done comms with Kern. He's awesome to work with. I would love to work with him again. It's just never worked out since then.
One thing that I love to do with these interviews is kind of go back and try to figure out how we got to know each other, because at some point, time just kind of muddles together in my brain. And it's like, oh yeah, I've known Drossy since the beginning. But that's obviously not true. Because you started, you know, volunteering in the community before I even started racing.
Right. And I was going to say, my first comms were August of 2018, where it was during the Overworld Glitches tournament, and they were basically looking for warm bodies, because who comms Overworld Glitches?
Right.
It was
right.
Like, as long as they had one comm who at least sort of knew what they were talking about, they could have the other comm there to ask questions. And
yeah,
I think I got paired with like Michael Kay or someone like that. And so we're talking like August 2018, I did a few comms for the Overworld Glitches tournament.
Wow. Where you're literally just asking what's going on here.
Right? Yeah, after the first couple of times, I got some idea of, you know, what you could do with these glitches. I didn't necessarily know the mechanics, but at least then I could anticipate what the runners would likely be going to do next.
I wonder why Overworld Glitches is the one category that hasn't really exploded in Link to the Past Randomizer. I'm not sure. Like, I haven't put my finger on it. Because like cross keys, when it first started, was kind of an albatross. There was people, including myself, that were like very fearful of attempting anything like that.
My best guess is on some level, when you allow a lot of glitches, there's a certain elegance that goes away. That when you restrict it to minor glitches, then you're at least somewhat playing the game like we played it as kids. You know, sure, we didn't know about fake flippering or, you know, icebreaker or whatever, but sure. It's still relatively close to the game we played as kids. Once you introduce Overworld Glitches or anything beyond that, HMG, no logic, it becomes so unlike the game we played as kids that then you're really just attracting the people who are interested in learning these crazy tricks for the sake of learning these crazy tricks.
Yeah, I also wonder if there's a fear of learning the tech, because a lot of it, if you do it wrong, kind of breaks the game a bit, right? Like, if you mess up Icebreaker, what's the worst that happens? You run out of magic, right? Or you miss the hammer jump, you fall off the ledge.
I mean, if you mess up fake flipper, that can be a problem.
That's true. Yeah, that one's true. But that's pretty, I mean, you can teach anyone to fake flipper pretty quickly, and for the most part, we'll have no real issues with it, but yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, so you're calming of all tournaments, the Overworld Glitches tournament.
Right.
And I imagine you're doing a lot of the dailies as well.
Some of the dailies. I can't remember when I did my first daily, but this was back when they were doing two main tournaments a year still. So the fall main tournament rolls around. Remember, Overworld Glitches was August, so it wasn't too long before the fall main tournament started. So then I actually have, you know, samples that I can provide on my application of previous comm work I've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my first main tournament, is that fall main tournament. I can't remember if I did any comms for that, but I remember getting destroyed. I was in a group with Airy. So right there, my group is pretty stacked. It was Airy, me, Airy, 1UP,
Lean. But you Atlas. Made it out of quals and into groups. That was good right there. They only allowed 96 people into groups for that one, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. But that was a strange tournament because you had to play everyone like three times.
Yep, six-person triple round robin.
Yeah, and so like you'd be eliminated, but you'd still have to play like six more races or something like that. It wasn't the best RAN tournament, but it was pretty fun still.
Yeah, and as luck would have it, the first race I commed in that tournament involved some little-known runner named Dante, who, you know. Oh,
nice.
What wasn't really amounting to much, lost that match and everything.
Well, so when did you first move into a moderator or admin role? Was it the league?
That was through you.
Okay. So
I mean, you started the league, you were advertising it. I nervously, you know, a few weeks, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks after you opened the server and started advertising it, I was like, I'll join the server, see what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
You
take a peek into ALTTPR, and next thing you're hooked. You take a little peek into what this league is, and you're hooked.
You already had your mod team, but then you put out a call for league helpers, and I was like, well, it would be fun, I think, to get more involved in an event around here, and you're looking for league helpers. It wasn't a really well-defined role or anything, but sure, I'll put my hat in the ring.
The first season of the league was held together by scotch tape. Like, I had no idea what I was doing, really. I relied on everyone else, and I remember you being hugely helpful because of how good you are, one, with numbers and organization. Like,
I think the big thing, Sigma wasn't involved at the time, so there wasn't like a fancy website, so we were doing a lot of it through Google Sheets.
Yeah, and that's right.
Just given my background, I'm pretty good with Google Sheets, and I think that's what it took in the end.
Yeah, because I did have a website, but it was really jank, because I can build them, but I'm not good at. I'm the, obviously do the art side, right? Like, but the technical side, I can't do databases and all that stuff. So I kind of had stuff on the website, but I feel like you preserved most of it on your Google Sheets, right?
And
I think you did most of it without me even asking you to do it, which was hugely helpful. Hugely helpful.
And also, you know, since I know formulas and stuff, I was getting it to automatically calculate team scores, whereas you had been doing that completely manually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember, I think I really relied on you for tiebreakers. And
well, the tiebreaker thing was a mess because that was, you hadn't quite planned it out, so not every team had played every other team in their division,
right.
So.
Yeah, that's right. That was a giant mess.
So and we then, wound up having a tiebreaker match after, you know, throwing up our hands and saying, well, this might be how you'd break the tiebreaker, but since A didn't play B and B didn't play C or whatever, the teams involved just agreed to have a tiebreaker match.
Yeah, I think that's what made that first season work, was everyone involved. Well, it was a lot of people that I knew, obviously, because no one knew what the league was. It was a brand new thing. So I brought a lot of friends into that first season, and they were just kind of cool with, let's kind of figure it out as we go. Because if you remember right, the playoffs were best of three, not best of five.
Well, and people, you know, pushed back against that once we got to playoff season, as I recall, like all the teams involved unanimously
voted
to change it to five, and that I think you had required unanimity because it said three in the doc. So if there was going to be a big change like that, people had to be unanimous.
It's so funny the stuff that I overlooked, you know, when you try to do something on your own. And I'm not a numbers guy. I mean, you of all people know that I'm not a numbers guy.
Well, it's funny because, like, on the admin team, like, you were the only one of us who totally didn't come from any sort of technical background.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I was just the idea guy, like, hey, let's do this, and then try to find people that could do it. And luckily, you decided to join up as a, I guess it was a league helper that season, right? Like, I didn't even know what that was.
Right after the season ended, I remember you dropped me a DM asking me if I'd consider being a mod for the next season. And I was just kind of floored. And I was like, sure. Okay. Sounds like, you know, I didn't really know what all mods did, but it seemed like a good way to get more involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so let's talk a little bit about the nightmare that was season two of the league. So you joined the league, you're more involved now. You went from the setup helper, which honestly was just a moderator. At, you know, like we didn't know what we were doing. We were flying by the seat of our pants. And
I wasn't in a position to approve crew or anything.
Yeah, not yet.
Or do setups or anything.
Sure, but. Did you do that in season two? What was your role in season two?
Season two, yeah, I was definitely approving crew and helping with the schedule and stuff.
Because, mm-hmm. Again, it's kind of a blur for me with all the seasons, because we did run season two and three in the same year, right?
Yeah, that was another can of worms. And season two, I mean, started right as the pandemic started. Mm-hmm. And I think that was also part of it in terms of my own level of involvement, that suddenly we're all under lockdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not going out and doing the stuff I used to do, but hey, I have this online outlet. I'm really gonna, you know, immerse myself in it. Mm-hmm. So I really kind of threw myself into the mod work because it gave me something to do on a personal level. My mom had also started chemotherapy for cancer again, as the lockdown began. So I needed something to take my mind off that. I certainly couldn't see my parents under the circumstances. Thankfully, she is totally good now.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. So let's reminisce a bit. Tell me about your memories of season two, because it was a crazy one. Season two was probably our craziest season.
Well, I mean, you know, you had reasonably figured, okay, for season one, you were hoping to at least get eight teams because you weren't going to run it without eight teams, and you were absolutely capping it at 16 because this was a new thing and you didn't want too many people to keep it a manageable size. So, you know, you capped it at 16, fine. So season two, you figured, okay, we know how to do it with 16. Let's try doubling it. We'll allow 32. And what was it? Registration filled up in less than a minute.
It was like 14 seconds. It was something ridiculous. And I was freaking out, right? Like, what do we do? That was the big question. Is like,
yeah, what? We had an emergency mod meeting, I remember, trying to figure it out. And
like an actual voice meeting, which I had never really done. Like, everything we do was Discord.
Oh, really?
This is voice.
I mean, I knew that I had never been involved as a league helper in voice meetings in season one, but I didn't know what you had done with the mods then.
No, that was the first time ever did a voice meeting. It was an emergency. Like, what do we do here? And what did we do? We capped it at 64. Is that what we did?
Yeah, basically, we knew there was pretty well enough interest to get us to 48, and 48's a good number to work with, not quite as good as 32 or 64, but we're like, okay, we can at least get to 48, and then if we can get 16 more teams, we'll do it with 64. Otherwise, anyone 49 and beyond to sign up is SOL.
Yeah. Because again, you were my numbers guy. I just remember relying on you so much to be like, all right, Drossy, you tell me, what can we do? And I remember that was also the season that you kind of helped figure out tiebreakers, which I feel like have constantly evolved a bit.
Yeah, right. I mean, then we had at least figured out a schedule so that with 8 teams per division in 7 weeks, every team did play every other team. So it was easier to have a tiebreaker system in place. And I remember we also hammered through that on one of those voice calls.
Yeah. What was your impression of the league? Because it was, again, all brand new. And for the most part, you've been a major part of it since the beginning.
It seemed cool. Obviously, the best thing, in my opinion, is it lets people play with their friends without having to necessarily play against their friends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's, in my view, like the best thing about the league.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So how did you think the season two went then, after our sort of freak out, 14-second sign up?
it's a bit of a blur, of course. I remember we had to scrounge those last few teams because we got up to about 61 and we didn't really want to have to turn 13 teams away. Yeah. So then it was like begging and pleading for 3 more teams to sign up so we could be at 64.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we did it.
Yeah.
And that season was crazy because we literally just threw 64 teams together with,
some curating to try to balance the divisions. But the problem is, since there was only one league, you know, while the divisions were equally competitive with each other for the most part, that meant that, you know, some teams were just totally waltzing through and some teams were just getting completely blown out of the water.
Yeah. And there was a lot of new people, right? Like, it was like, I always tried to stay out of at least division alignment and scheduling as far as who plays who when, because I played in the league. I didn't want to compromise that. So it was always up to the people that weren't playing in the divisions or weren't playing in the league, primarily you, putting together the divisions, which I feel like you've kind of led the last couple of years. And then,
and I can't even remember who I worked with on that. The first time around.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe PFLAN, maybe Cassidy Mellon, maybe.
PFLAN, I remember helping a lot in season 3.
Yeah.
I honestly don't remember who helped with that in season 2, because I sure didn't know a lot of these runners.
Yeah, it was a lot of really, there was a huge intake of new players coming into the league and into Rando. And it's like, how do you judge any of them? You don't know.
And
who they
are. Some of these were, you know, players who had come out of the 2019, the original 2019 mentor tournament. I remember when you were doing the reveal stream, you were shouting out mentor tournament teams.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're totally right. So, here's a question I have for you that's kind of always been on my mind: is putting together not just for season 2, but season 3 and 4. Putting the teams in the divisions, right? So it's a thankless job for sure, because when it happens, everyone has an opinion on if it's right or not,
and it's much worse for Open League, because at this point, you know, if you're in Invitational League, I probably know you. I probably have some sense of your ability level. And I just have to sit down with someone like PFLAN or Megawatt and we hammer it through.
Mm-hmm.
So Invitational League at this point, especially since we've capped it at 32 teams, is relatively easy to do the divisions with. You know, I even know which Europeans are degens, and we can expect that they'd race at 3 a.m. their time, so we can put them in a North American division, whereas, and likewise, which North Americans might be able to race in the middle of the afternoon. So for the Invitational League, there's definitely an element of familiarity that makes designing the divisions easier at this point.
Yeah. It's the beast of the Open, right?
Right. And, you know, starting to get a system down. Who did I... I had like maybe like Moogle and Cassidy and Dazed Cloud and Megawatt all try to evaluate the relative strengths of the Open League teams based on what they knew.
Yeah. Just trying to get opinions on stuff that you don't have an opinion on, right?
Like, right. I mean, there was only so much I knew about players in the Open League. Mm-hmm. And having a team of people who either knew some of these players or could research their ladder histories or race time histories or something to get a sense of them.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, you know, I got feedback from all of them and I made rankings. I can't remember. Yeah, I wound up doing this for season three as well. I think like it was Shireen and Lynn helping in season three and then the people I mentioned before helping in season four. But, you know, I just was like, okay,
yeah.
Okay, these are the eight teams, since we have eight divisions in the Open League, who I'm going to call first seeds. They may or may not actually finish first, but who on the whole I would expect, based on the feedback I'm getting, that they're likely to finish first. And then eight teams I'm calling second seeds, eight teams I'm calling third seeds, so on down the line.
Yeah.
And then try to do first sort by time zones so that we don't have West Coasters playing Europeans.
Right.
People in the middle of the continent get mad enough at me when I put them against Europeans.
Sure.
Yeah. And now that it's a multi-season thing, also another consideration if you're, you know, in North America, it's like, did I put you against North Europeans last season? Well, I probably shouldn't do that this season because that would just be unfair. So, you know, time zones really factor in heavily to trying to,
which is so hard because not everyone in the time zone plays at, I quote, regular times, right?
Right. We don't all have Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 jobs to begin with.
Yeah. So season two happens. It's successful for sure because of the growth, but it was a hard tournament to run because, again, we're figuring out what the hell is going on, right? Like, season one was a mess, season two was a bigger mess, but we managed it and people had fun.
Right, and you had a bigger mod team for season two.
Yeah.
I mean, you were still the sole admin at that point. I can't even imagine what you went through.
Yeah, I don't even remember. I blocked it all out. So I was a sole admin season two. I knew that I couldn't sole admin anymore. Like, it just was not possible. So I ended up bringing you, Dante, Relkin, and Sigma in, I believe. That was the first five.
Right. And again, I was just like taken aback, didn't quite know how to respond when you DM'd me and asked if I'd consider being an admin. And I was like, oh, what does that involve? Who else are you bringing in?
Yeah. It was a fun, it's a fun five people though.
Like, oh, I absolutely. Like, I think you did a fantastic job getting the five of us together.
Yeah. It was because one, it took a ton of weight off of my shoulders, not having to carry everything or make all of the final decisions and be able to collaborate. And I knew that you specifically brought so much to the table that I just didn't have knowledge or understanding or know how to do. And I think that was kind of went into.
Which is funny because I look at Sigma and it's like, I can't do a tenth of the stuff he does.
Right. Well, I mean, that's how I feel about everyone, right? Like, and I think that's what made the admin crew good, is that we all kind of had our parts and we knew what our parts were and we all had an equal voice. And that's when we split the league into open and invitational.
What
were your thoughts going into season three and the new responsibilities? Like, how did you feel becoming an admin and how do you feel season three went with your new responsibilities?
I was nervous as hell about doing setups. That was a whole new scary thing because you were, I'd never done a setup before. You were doing a lot of the setups yourself in season two.
That was the big thing. And so I started the league as I was like the guy kind of running the SG dailies, right? Like, so I would pick all the runners for the dailies and I'd kind of get them going, because I work from home, I can manage all that stuff pretty easily. And that kind of expanded into the league because I knew that, which helped make the league bigger, was having that platform of speed gaming, restreaming it. And season
right,
two,
which is ironic because, of course, from my end, you know, then being involved in the league, then starting doing setups and getting more involved with speed gaming and stuff like that is what led Fiesel to eventually ask me to be volunteer coordinator.
right. So it was like a reverse. But season two with, we had 64 teams and we restreamed, almost all of it on speed gaming.
There was one week where we did actually literally restream every single match.
And speed gaming needs restream helpers to set this races up. And it's a thankless job. And it takes some work, especially when there's as many tournaments that we had going or races that we had going in the tournament or in the league.
Killed me. 64 races a week, and speed gaming was often picking up 50 of them.
Yeah, that killed me. And I was, because I was the only one doing the SG help as the admin of the league. And that's the thing I remember now that you reminded me is when I added you four, it was you have to become a speed gaming helper. Were you nervous about that? Did you?
Oh, very. I mean. And it really took me a while before I really felt comfortable doing it.
Yeah.
You know, things would go wrong. I wouldn't necessarily know how to fix them. I'd ping for help and then feel a bit embarrassed when I realized it was something I was capable of doing myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so a lot of work went into that. Season three, I felt like, and you can tell me what you think, was probably our most successful season.
I would agree. It was certainly the most balanced season, just in terms of if you go back and look through the standings of every season, looking at what the team records were.
Mm-hmm. I think I liked it the most because my team finished second overall.
that was also, good for you. You know, you brought in this guy Gamachu, and that kind of upped the ante a bit.
Yeah, he just rode his coattails all the way to the end.
Season two, I thought, was where you guys finished second, actually.
Oh, was it? You think you're right. I can't remember. We lost to Team Moss in season two. Yeah, you're right. So never mind. Season three sucked.
Season three was Fendrana Drifters just coasting through everything.
Yeah, I guess they destroyed everyone.
Yeah, so everyone yelled at me about that division because Fendrana Drifters just demolished everyone. And I was like, if you look at that division, there are a lot of other really good teams in that division. There's no reason why Fendrana Drifters necessarily should have beaten every single one of them every single time. Uh-huh. It just happened that way, and people had this perception that the division was incredibly imbalanced because Fendrana Drifters just had that insane season.
Yeah. But that's not true. They earned it. They beat some really, really good teams. They knocked us,
including your team, I think.
Yeah, they did. So before we talk about season four, because season four has stuff that happened that I'd like to get your opinion on a little bit. I am no longer an admin for the league. It's now you. Now it's you. Four. You.
Right.
We ended up bringing Amerithin, and Sigma moved to like a bot overlord and has kind of moved back-ish into the admin.
He is server owner, so, that comes with certain responsibilities.
For sure.
We all agree that if we take, if the four of us tie a vote, he has to cast the tiebreaker.
Yeah.
So it hasn't happened yet, but if it happens.
So, I'm on the outside. I have all these stories, obviously, being the creator and a big part of running the whole thing for the last four seasons. What's it like? What's the future of the league now?
I mean, we had our first organizing meeting. When was that? About 2 weeks or so ago, middle of May. Mm-hmm. We are already starting to talk about season five. We certainly haven't locked anything down. I can tell you one thing for absolute sure. It's going to be after the online portion of SGL.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. That's in, what, July or something?
No, that's the end of September. So there is zero chance of season 5 starting before October.
Oh, that's good to know. You got breaking news here. Season 5.
That's cool. Well, it's okay. By the time this airs, it'll be like July anyway.
Sure. Where, like, as someone that's, you know, designing where the, you know, part of the infrastructure of what the league becomes, what do you want to see of the league become?
I mean, you know, one of the important things to me in that initial organizing meeting, and we've had discussions about that, as I'm sure you remember, for season 4, we suddenly had to cap registration because we didn't have a plan for going beyond 96 teams.
Yeah.
So it was very important to me to not run into that wall again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm not going to get into details here.
Sure, because, yeah, we don't need the details.
You know, we'll see how many teams actually sign up, but we do have a plan in place to accommodate up to 116 teams. And I said, if more than 116 teams register for season 5, I don't know where these people are coming from.
Yeah. I mean, the league, the not just the league, but the community continues to grow and grow, right? Like, it felt like the 512 was the height because that's a ton of players. And there's, I'm not sure how many runners are on the registered on the ladder, but I feel like it's a few hundred. But it feels like the community is still growing.
And of course we have another mentor tournament getting underway, and that's going to produce all sorts of players, I'm sure, who want to put together league teams.
Mm-hmm. Do you imagine going over 90? Was it 96 for season 4?
Well, I mean, a lot of the admins were like, oh, we'll never get that many again. And I was like, guys, we said this last time. I mean, I can't imagine we'll go too much over 100, but prove me wrong.
Yeah. What about the state of the game? Do you think the game is in a good spot for racers?
It feels that way. I mean, it was interesting, of course, listening to your and Dante's discussion about the early days of the council and what that was like, that I think, you know, with the role of the council having stabilized now, I think that's helped stabilize a lot of things about the game, that it doesn't, racing doesn't feel like the Wild West anymore. And also, you know, the transition from SRL to race time.
Yeah, that was huge.
I mean, from my perspective, I never used IRC. I don't know what I would have been able to do if you had made me an admin back when it was still on SRL.
Yeah, you're lucky. It's not the worst thing, but it's not intuitive at all. So you get used to it, but it definitely caused more problems than it was worth. Let's talk season 4. Season 4, I would say, was a super success. Like, it felt like it ran, the tournament ran itself. The league season 4 ran itself in a lot of ways. I don't know. You tell me. Tell me what you thought about season 4. Yeah,
right. I mean, looking back, it's hard to remember how much of it really did run smoothly because, of course, we focus on the stuff that didn't.
Right. It's so easy to pick the one thing because it was a pretty big moment in the league.
And obviously there was that moment, but also, like, the headaches we were getting from open leaguers about Spoiler Pilot.
Right. Yeah, Spoiler Pilot. There was also a cheater found in the midst of
the season. Well, two cheaters, really. One person who cheated during a league match and another person who got banned by the council for cheating in other matches. As far as we know, that person wasn't cheating in league matches, but, you know, the council ban forced us to kick that person out of the league as well.
Maybe it wasn't a successful season.
The only time we've had a team withdraw mid-season and we had to scramble around that.
Yeah, we had to figure out what to do. Like, you can't... That was definitely a headache. But let's talk about the ending of the season. Now, the Titans Mitts are the legit champions of season 4. There's no question there. But from an admin... we're going to just look at this from an admin perspective and maybe your personal perspective as well. But we had a game crash. I feel like the admins handled it as well as we could. There was definitely fallout. I mean,
I think we were in a bit of a panic at the moment, how I remember it being, that, like, especially since it was right at the end of the race. If a crash like that happens a half hour in, it's a totally different situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess we'll to give context, Gamma Chew in Game 4's game crashed with a decent sized lead against Sailor Nep.
I recall, she was still in GT basement and he was on the climb. So, you know, 3 minutes ish.
Yeah. And his console crashed. Now, we never told Nep that she had to offer a rematch, because that's
and it's also worth noting that Gamma didn't say in the race time chat where he had been at when he crashed. Mm-hmm. And Nep, because she was getting the big key and then doing the climb, didn't even see Gamma's forfeit and message until she was on the cutscene after Agate 2.
Yeah. So give me your perspective on everything that kind of happened. Because again, this is not to delegitimize the Titans mints or anything, but it's handling. I mean, this was a big moment in the league because one, it cost you an admin, and two, there's a lot of fallout. I mean, like, Schulzer ended up getting a temporary ban from racing for harassment and things like that. And it kind of changed policy a little bit. It was obviously not a fun moment, but,
I think
deal with
hindsight is 2020, right? I think our biggest mistake was trying to get a statement out of Nep right then and there as to what she was going to do.
Yeah. Which she didn't have to do anything, right? Like, she won the race legit.
Right.
It's unfortunate that Gamma's game crashed, but that's unfortunately part of, you know, what happens with these things.
Right. But the fact that we immediately consulted with her and she immediately said that she wouldn't be able to do a rematch, and that we then had the comms announce that on the air within minutes of this all happening. I think in hindsight, that was our big mistake, rather than giving it some time, not announcing it on the air.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, this.
But I remember how frantic I felt, and you and I were messaging. I forget where Marith was at. Obviously, you know, Relkin recused himself. I think it was late enough at night that Dante, with his old man hours, was asleep.
Right. Yeah, he woke up to, you know, a mountain of messages for sure. we kind of had to deal with it. You know, Skull Kids ended up forfeiting Game 5, and then that allowed the Titans mitts to move on.
Was just really unfortunate, too, that remember, on
yes,
the one hand, like, Titans mitts, I think, would have liked to have put up a good fight in Game 5 and then lost legitimately so that they could have a clear conscience about everything.
Yeah. It's interesting to look back because we do have perspective, right? Titans mitts are 100% the champions. There's no asterisks. There's no nothing. They are the champions.
Yeah, absolutely. But
it was definitely a trying time.
Skull Kids chose to forfeit that Game 5.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, I just couldn't fathom. as a former member of Skull Kids and as the admin, and just, you know, when I created the league, it was to be fun. It was supposed to be a fun way to play with your friends. And when something grows to the size that it grows, it kind of doesn't become. It's not your baby anymore, right? And it is kind of what it is. So,
I mean, there's also the artifact of, you know, we are recording all these races on race time, so it has to, you know, they all have to be done in accordance with
the rules,
council rulings of how races need to be conducted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the future is bright. I'm really excited about what you guys are doing for the league and where it's going to go, because I'm like everyone else now. I get a bitch when you guys don't put my favorite mode in.
Yeah, and I'll just point the finger at the other admins for that, because I'm sure that as active players that they'll have much more say in what modes we do than I will.
Yeah, for sure.
We are definitely taking a year off of Spoiler Pilot, though.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Are you surprised after everything?
I mean, again, but for someone who's been behind the scenes, definitely not surprised at all. But I know that there will be people that will be disappointed. And then
it happens. We took a year off Cross Keys. We brought it back. I think it works better now. There are a lot more people who play cross keys now, so I think it fits better in the league.
Yeah, for sure.
So if we take a season off spoiler pilot and then potentially bring it back in season six, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Okay, so we actually do have a question for you in the Discord. From Lumaga says, Drossi, you travel a lot. Where are the best, most interesting, and worst, least interesting places you've been to? Which is interesting. You are one of the people who have met a lot of people in the community just because of your travels. Like
including you. I mean,
yeah.
You're elusive. I should ask, have you met anyone in the community besides me?
Not in person, no.
Yeah. I mean, I know you and GGW have this thing that you're only a couple of hours apart from each other. And,
it just hasn't worked out, for me and GGW to hang out. But you're all over the place. You just got back from, where was it, the Netherlands or something?
Norway. I was actually hanging out with Noble Foxes.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun being out there. So it was my first time in the country.
Where's the best, most interesting and worst and least interesting places you've been to?
I mean, for like, my favorite cities are, without a question, London and Tel Aviv. In terms of if I want to pick cities I'd hang out in.
What is that? What is about them you like?
In the case of London, just like, you know, the culture's incredible. On a certain level, London and New York are in their own category in world cities, just in terms of a combination of size and culture.
Yeah.
And between the two, I find London to be a bit more approachable, maybe because I grew up, 3 hours from New York going there, once or twice every year. And, Tel Aviv, I just love that it's so modern, but still kind of compact. It has the beach like right there. It has incredible beaches all up and down the coast, right next to this modern city that has all these amenities of being a modern city, and then you have all the history there as well.
Yeah,
it's just a pretty incredible combination.
Mm-hmm.
Singapore, I guess, would be my distant third, just because they're so amazingly multicultural. Definitely, I feel like that's the most diverse place I've ever been, and the food scene there is a result of how multicultural it is. You get incredible Chinese food, incredible Indian food, incredible Southeast Asian food. Just don't try to get Western food there. A hamburger will cross an arm and a leg.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Well, okay, so what places suck? Where to stay away from?
In terms of where I just kind of felt miserable, in this country, I hated Houston, and apologies to anyone from there. Your city has no redeeming features, I'm sorry to say.
I'll take that, Houston.
I mean, I had to go to a wedding there once. It was in late May, and that's not the best time of year to be in Houston.
It is
literally a swamp. So it's like 100 degrees, 100% humidity, mosquitoes everywhere.
Oh, man.
I'm all dressed up for the wedding, and of course they do the cocktail hour outdoors.
Oh, geez.
So that's like my memories of Houston.
Oh, man.
Rio didn't particularly impress me either. I just never felt very safe there. And I managed to get food poisoning, so that didn't help matters either.
Yeah.
And then Cambodia, Siem Reap, Cambodia. Angkor Wat is beautiful, but it just felt too rustic and undeveloped for my comfort level.
I see.
So those were the places I can particularly remember being just kind of feeling miserable because of something about.
Man, you're such a world traveler. That's so awesome. I'm very jealous.
I mean, it's fun seeing places.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so we're gonna end this the way I end all of my conversations, and that's talking a little bit about tilt and how to handle it. Now, you don't play the game. You play a handful of seeds, I know.
I mean, I've certainly, when I do play, I get tilted in a hurry.
For sure. So you know the experience. So,
oh, very much so, yeah.
What's your advice for handling tilt? How do you manage it? And what's your thoughts on handling and managing tilt specifically to the Link to the Past randomizer?
I mean, I think sometimes you just need to step away for a bit.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're tilted in the middle of a tournament, I wouldn't advise that, just because, you know, people withdrawing in the middle of the tournament, and I've been guilty of this in the Mentor tournament a few years ago. You know, that always throws a little bit of a wrench into the works when someone withdraws in the middle of a tournament. But
yeah,
in general, if you can take time to step away, I think just stepping away and collecting yourself a bit is the best thing to do.
Yeah, that's good advice and something that I'm imploring right now. So.
Yes, I noticed you qualified and then decided not to participate in the main.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes it's good just to walk away for a while. You know what? There's so many things that I wish we could get to, including you as a commentator, because you've done a ton of commentating and you're such a good commentator. So we're going to have you back, Drosley. I'm going to have you back on the show and we'll cover some more stuff.
Well, I hope you get through a lot more people for their first time before you have me back.
Well, we're definitely going to have to talk about to get you back, though, because I want people to hear your advice on commentating stuff, because you are, I feel like you're one of the best commentators out there. And
thanks. I still feel like I'm just kind of average and just, you know, try to say what's on my mind and be a bit entertaining when I do it.
Sure. But you got knowledge and you got experience and you, all without even playing the game, you know a lot. So yeah, thanks for coming on, Drosley. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me. This has been a blast.
Thanks again to Drosley for joining me on the show today. And just a really fun conversation. I'm, again, always fascinated by people that are so ingrained in the community and don't race or even really play the game. But he has a love for Link to the Past. He has a love for the community that keeps him around and working behind the scenes and sometimes in the comm booth as well to help make the restreams great. And I think he does an excellent job, and I'm glad to call him friend. Really, honestly, that's the big thing, is I'm just glad he's my friend. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I really did. And all the stuff with the league is, I hope it's interesting. Like, I've been a part of it since the beginning and know all of what's gone on. So I always worry, like, am I just talking into a void a bit, or does anybody even care about this stuff? I hope you found it interesting. If you did, talk about it in the Discord. Again, the Discord link is on the website, 216pod.com. Join the Discord and let me know what you think about the episode. Let me know what you're watching for GDQ, if you're watching it. And show Drosley some love if you enjoyed the episode. Subscribe where you can to the podcast, Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I think we got another 5-star review, so super appreciate that. That just helps get the show out to people. Tell your friends that you're listening to the show and enjoying it, and help me get my subscriber count up, listener count up. I'm having a blast recording these episodes. I just recorded another one that's going to be coming out later this month. It's a real conversation. it's got some real stuff in it, and it's really cool. So I'm excited about the episodes that are coming out. Speaking of the episodes that are coming out, we've got Sigma coming out on this Thursday. Oh man, Sigma's my dude. He's just my dude. I was really excited to get him on the show, but I wasn't sure if he would actually do it, because Sigma's not someone that likes a lot of attention on him, but I want to shine as much attention on him as I can, just because he does so much. Much like Drosley, these two are super invaluable to what the league is and the future and the success of the league as well. So, all right, thanks again for listening to the show, and I really appreciate it. We'll see you next week.